Hello, my name is Dario Balca, student coordinator for the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that UBC's Vancouver Point Grey campus is situated on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. For those listening to this recording outside of this area, I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners and caretakers of those lands. It's August 13th, 2020, and I'm joined today by Andrew Gay, QC. Andrew's a litigator in Vancouver specializing in government liability, regulatory disputes, commercial litigation, employment law, defamation, and more. He's also been involved with the law school as an adjunct professor, teaching an upper year seminar on government liability. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
I want to start by asking you how you ended up on the West Coast and how you became involved with the Allard School of Law in a teaching capacity, because I know you graduated from Osgoode Hall in 1996.
So I was born and raised on the West Coast, so it wasn't so much a matter of ending up here. I went back east for law school and also for a master's program in environmental studies at York. But very soon after arriving in Toronto, reached the conclusion that I didn't want to stay there. So began plotting my return to Vancouver. And in my second year of law school, one of the things I did in that regard is I took a visiting semester away from Osgoode and went to UVic Law School for one semester. And that was the semester during which people would typically prepare their application materials for articles. And so it was kind of strategic. And when I was at UVic, I applied for articles at the Ministry of Attorney General in Victoria. I was successful in that application and accepted their offer, and so ended up articling at the ministry in Victoria. After a couple of years, moved over to a private firm in Vancouver, where I still am. In terms of the issue of teaching at the law school, it turns out is connected to my work for government, because I got to know a number of government lawyers while doing government work, and that continued after I left government as I continued to work on a number of their files for them on a contract basis. And one of the lawyers I got to know is Karen Horstman, QC, who is now a judge of the BC Supreme Court. And Karen had an idea that it would benefit the profession if there was a course at the law school that taught students about the Crown and about suing the Crown. Because in her experience as a government lawyer, there were many instances where she came across lawyers who really didn't understand that suing the Crown involved different considerations and different issues of law as compared to regular lawsuits involving private citizens. And so she asked me if I would co-teach with her. And I agreed, and she worked on the curriculum, and I helped edit that, and then we helped plan the course together and the lectures, and then we divided up the teaching requirements, and that's how it began.
Could you elaborate a bit more on the contents of what you teach and what you feel the students gain from those seminars?
Yeah, so just to be clear, I'm actually no longer teaching the course. I taught it with Karen for about 8 years. And then when she was appointed a judge, we decided that we would hand off the teaching reins to some younger lawyers who have now taken over the course. And that happened, I guess, about 2 years ago. But in those years when I was teaching, the course focused on a few things. So firstly, it commenced with a discussion of how to conceive of the Crown in our law. What is the Crown? What place does the Crown have in our legal system? How is the Crown treated differently than an individual, historically and presently? And then we moved into a discussion of whom the Crown can be liable for. And that involves issues of vicarious liability in a government context. And it involves issues of non-delegable duty, which is a doctrine that typically involves liability for the acts of independent contractors. And then we would move into issues relating to direct liability of the Crown in relation to different torts or causes of action. So we would spend a couple lectures on the Crown's liability in negligence. We had a class on the Crown's liability in nuisance, Crown liability in fiduciary duty, Crown liability in contract, Crown liability under the charter, so i.e. charter damages under Section 24. And we also had a class that looked at the intersection between civil actions against the Crown versus administrative law proceedings against government, and how you would know when to bring which kind of proceeding versus the other. And that's more or less it. There might have been a couple other topics that I'm forgetting about, but that's mostly what the course covered.
I kind of wanted to ask you about your experience at the law school in terms of, so you went to Osgoode Hall, you taught for a while at UBC, and you, like you were saying, you had some experience at UVic as well. And people often ask, you know, what our law school is like. And there's a lot of information out there about the academic side and what's on offer to any prospective students. But I wonder if you can, like, how you reflect on the community at Allard.
Well, I can't say too much about the community at Allard because as an adjunct professor who would only come there in the evenings once a week or once every 2 weeks, you don't really get a feel for the community at Allard. Your administration would be mad at me for saying this, but I'll say it anyway, even though I'm being recorded, which is, to be blunt, I didn't sometimes feel that the work provided by adjuncts was shown sufficient appreciation. And I'm not upset about it, don't get me wrong. But if the law school wants to learn from these interviews, it would do well to recognize the very, very significant time commitment put in by adjunct professors. And it's not a matter of remuneration. We all basically do it for free. And I don't think anybody's looking for money out of it. But more of an effort could be made, I think, to bring the adjuncts into the law school community. And I think the adjuncts would have appreciated more time with the dean and with other professors and some ways in which their contributions could be recognized, whether an end of year function or something of that nature. So I don't feel we were really brought into the law school community in a significant way. In some ways, unfortunate.
Interesting. Yeah. When you talk about, you just mentioned the time commitment that adjunct professors put in. Can you tell me a bit about, and we'll talk about your practice in a bit, but can you tell me a bit about what it's like to kind of balance those commitments, if there is a balancing act to be done there in terms of private practice and teaching?
Yeah, it's a significant commitment. As anybody who has been an adjunct professor knows, it's a significant time commitment because not only are you teaching the course, which in my case was only once every other week for 3 hours because Karen Horstman and I split the teaching duties. But of course, there's a significant time commitment in terms of preparing lectures. And that's true even if you've taught the course before, because you, of course, have an obligation to ensure that what you are teaching remains current. And so it may well be that there is a lot of effort that will have to be put into reading case law as it evolves in the area that you're teaching and preparing notes for students, preparing fact patterns that might be important, preparing midterm assignments and ultimately a final exam or topics for final papers. And sometimes we would update the curriculum, and that takes a fair bit of effort. So it is a very significant time commitment. And for somebody who's in private practice, particularly if they've got a busy practice as I do, it is a juggling act. And of course, on top of the teaching and the practice, one also has other professional obligations like contributing to the CLE programs downtown. And things outside of law, which in my case included coaching soccer and various other things. So yeah, it's a real juggling act, and it's difficult to do. But you know, there were rewards as well. Teaching was a rewarding aspect of my career.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit about your practice. Your career seems to have focused, broadly speaking, in the areas of civil litigation and administrative law. Could you tell me what drew you to those areas and what's kept you interested in them over the years?
Well, the backdrop to that is that when I was in law school, I thought I was going to do environmental law, like hundreds of other students thought. And I had done a joint program in law and environmental studies at York, and came out of it with a master's degree in environmental studies, and had a number of connections in the environmental law community, and had worked in that community in my summers. But, you know, you take articles where you get them, and I took articles with government. And at the end of my articling year, I asked them to put me in their environmental law group, because they did have such a group in Victoria. And their response was that they had no openings in that group, but they had an opening in civil litigation, and I could take that if I wanted it. Having no other options at the time, I took what was offered. That's how I ended up in litigation. If you'd asked me in law school if that was the route I was going to go, I would have said absolutely not, because I found my civil litigation course to be the driest course that I ever took in university. Unfortunately, taught by someone who I don't think was a practitioner. I think that course needs to be taught by practitioners. That's just an aside. In any event, so I ended up in litigation pretty much as a fluke of circumstance, but immediately enjoyed it. And I think what I have always enjoyed about it is the advocacy component. I enjoy helping other people solve their problems. I like advocating for them. I do enjoy making submissions in court. And so litigation has been a good fit for me. It's an area of law that does two things better than solicitor's work. Number one, it involves you in the law and the evolution of the law much more than solicitor's work does, I think. And secondly, it brings you into contact with more people with more real problems than the typical solicitor's job would. I mean, a solicitor's role typically is focused on people's business transactions. But somebody who does general litigation like I do encounters people in all kinds of sectors, in all kinds of problems. And so it's a kind of a broader connection to our society and to people and the things those people are doing in our society. So that, I think, is a nice aspect of being a litigator. Yeah. Anyway, so after I took the litigation position in government, I've never looked back, and I've been a general litigator ever since. That's not to say I do everything. I do have certain focuses, which we can talk about if you want, but that's the backstory.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit about what those sort of focus areas are?
Well, I do a lot of work for the provincial government, and that, of course, flowed from the early part of my career where I articled, and I spent 1 year in their litigation group after articling. And for reasons I won't get into, my departure from government was on very good terms. And as a consequence, they continued to send me work after I left. And they continue to send me work to this day. In fact, the most recent decision I have received from my work is a decision in the Supreme Court of Canada on behalf of the Attorney General of British Columbia. So I have a sort of expertise in government liability as a result both of teaching and as a result of the casework I do. I mean, I do general litigation beyond government litigation. I do commercial litigation. I do non-commercial and non-government tort litigation. So I do have a generalist background. But I'd say probably a quarter of my work is government litigation. I'd say another quarter of my work is civil forfeiture, which is also government related, as you know. And then I would say another quarter is administrative law, including professional discipline. And then I'd say the final quarter is a mishmash of commercial litigation and tort litigation.
In doing some reading about you for this interview, over the last 20 years or so, you've been involved in a number of pretty significant cases. I was wondering if you can touch on some moments that you see as highlights and tell me why those stand out to you.
Yes, I can do that. Well, looking back to the early years, there are two cases that stand out for me. when I was a junior lawyer. One was my first trip to the Supreme Court of Canada on a case called R versus Sharp, which you may have learned about either in criminal law or in charter law. It's one of the leading decisions on freedom of expression, as you may be aware. And I was junioring John McAlpin, QC, who was at the time one of the leading lawyers, litigators in Western Canada. And we acted for the BC Civil Liberties Association, which was granted intervener status in the Sharp appeal. And so I worked with John and on that case, which was terrific. And we also brought in Professor Bruce Ryder from Osgoode Hall, who's an expert in the charter. And so we got to work closely with him as well. He was a former professor of mine, actually. So he knew me from when I was a student. And so to work with those experts was fantastic. And to get to go to the Supreme Court of Canada was fantastic on what still stands as one of the leading cases on freedom of expression in Canada. It was a terrific experience. I didn't get to speak at the court, of course. I was only about a 1 or 2 year lawyer at that point. But just to be able to go and to watch was a fantastic, fantastic experience. Another case that is memorable for me from the early part of my career involves a case in which the government of British Columbia, for whom I was acting, sued Canadian Forest Products for having negligently started a forest fire. And I was junioring a lawyer by the name of Doug Eastwood QC, who's now the late Doug Eastwood QC. He passed away a couple of years ago. Doug was not that senior at the time, and he was probably only an 8 to 10 year lawyer at the time, and I was a 1 or 2 year lawyer at the time. And we were up against a big downtown law firm, and we were outgunned and out-resourced, but we prevailed. And I'll tell you a couple interesting things about the case. First, in terms of proving liability, I won't bore you with the whole way in which this forest fire started, but it goes back to the classic phrase, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. Well, a significant feature of the case is whether or not there was evidence of smoke in the spring of the year in which the fire emerged. And there was some conflicting evidence about this until such time, literally 2 days before the trial was to begin, we found a witness who was a summer student for Canfor at the time, who was now driving taxi in Nelson, British Columbia. We found this guy, and sure enough, he confirmed that A, he spotted smoke, and B, he reported it to his supervisor. The supervisor being the guy who was examined on examination for discovery, who denied that there was ever a sighting of smoke. And what was particularly memorable about this was that because we were working for the Ministry of Forests on this matter, we had access to airplanes. So we got the Ministry of Forests to fly an airplane down to Nelson to pick this guy up and fly him back to Prince George to appear as a witness in trial. That actually happened. This guy testified, and his evidence combined with a couple others basically sunk Canfor, which was found liable for this forest fire. The second memorable thing about this case is that it too went to the Supreme Court of Canada. I didn't go to Ottawa because they gave that job to some other government lawyers, but the issue in that case that the Supreme Court of Canada was interested in had to do with the valuation of trees that were in a riparian zone, which were not scheduled for harvest. And we hadn't led any evidence at trial of environmental degradation caused by the burning of these trees. We took a simpler approach, at least we thought it was a simpler approach. We basically said, you can attach a minimum value to these trees. The minimum value is the value that the government is giving up or foregoing by taking them outside of the harvest area. So the government, as you know, normally gets stumpage for trees that companies cut. It's like a royalty. Mm-hmm. We said the minimum value of these trees must be that royalty, because if the government doesn't value them at least that much, they'd allow them to be cut. The Court of Appeal partially agreed with us and gave us a sort of half award. And the Supreme Court of Canada rejected that, which I still don't understand. Anyway, the Supreme Court of Canada basically said, well, you didn't plead this as an environmental case. You didn't lead evidence of environmental loss, and so you can't get environmental damages. Anyway, this case, Canfor, stands as the leading case on environmental damages for tort from the Supreme Court of Canada. Effectively, it says two things. One, you can get environmental damages, which was a breakthrough. But number two, unfortunately, there's all sorts of dicta in the decision about how one might go about proving environmental damages. And in my view, what they did in that regard was kind of a disservice, because it's a very difficult and cumbersome process for trying to prove environmental damages that will be very costly and with a very uncertain result. And to my knowledge, very, very few people or governments have attempted to do so since then.
I wanted to ask you also, you're a member of the, or you've been a member of the Civil Resolution Tribunal. I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about how you became in that role. And whenever I talk to people who take on these kinds of positions, I'm always curious about what you gain from that kind of an experience that you wouldn't necessarily just in your regular practice.
Well, what happened when they set up the tribunal, I think they had a list of people they targeted as potential tribunal members. And they invited those people to apply, and then there was an interview process that we had to go through and so on. So it was, I was approached rather than simply submitting an application. And probably because they knew I had administrative law experience, I suspect that's why. In any event, there was a lengthy period of time when we basically did nothing before the tribunal got up and running. And I only worked on the small claims side of it. I didn't work on the strata side of it. And then there was a period of about a year when I was rendering decisions for the CRT in small claims cases. But then after that year, what happened is the tribunal decided that it was more effective for them to hire in-house people that would have sort of full-time decision-making jobs rather than using lawyers in the community to act as decision-makers. And so the model switched, and that was probably about 2 years ago now. And in the last 2 years, I have not had really any role with them, just so you're aware. And I think that's true of all the sort of private lawyers that they initially recruited. They've gone to an in-house model. But in any event, to answer your question, I was interested in it for a few reasons. Firstly, I thought the whole concept of an online tribunal that was designed to make access to dispute resolution very easy for people and very cost efficient for people, where they wouldn't have to use lawyers, where they would get some facilitation by people at the tribunal and so on to help facilitate the disputes, was an interesting idea and a good idea. And I liked the idea that we would have in our society a way to facilitate the resolution of small disputes, because small disputes aren't economic to resolve with the involvement of lawyers and often with the involvement of a court. Yet small disputes are important to resolve, because if you don't resolve them, you end up with large numbers of people full of resentments and bitterness and acrimony and looking for ways to get back at other people and not feeling satisfied and feeling picked on or used or whatever the case may be. And so it's actually a good thing to resolve small disputes, and most disputes in our society are small disputes. And so the person that hires a landscaper who comes in and messes up their property and does a half-assed job, well, they might only be, you know, interested to the extent of a few $1,000s, but having that rectified and having a neutral, competent decision maker resolve that for them, I think, is of great benefit. So I think the whole project is a good project, firstly. And as far as benefiting me, I mean, did it benefit me? Probably. I mean, it is interesting as a litigator to be on the other side, where you're writing a decision, you're assessing evidence, and you're writing a decision, because it reminds you sort of what is important. It reminds you about how to focus on the key issues, and it reminds you what what good advocacy looks like and doesn't look like and those sorts of things. So that's of some benefit. And also, I thought it was possible down the road that if I were to expand my practice into arbitration, it might be helpful in that regard. Or if I wanted to work for other tribunals, it may be helpful in that regard as well. I haven't taken those steps, but that did cross my mind as well.
I noticed you've also served as a co-chair of the administrative law subsection of the Canadian Bar Association in BC, and as well as the National Executive Committee of the administrative law subsection. Why do you think it's important for lawyers to have their interests represented through these mechanisms and to be connected to each other through these organizations?
Well, there's a few answers to that. I mean, number one, it's important for lawyers themselves to remain current in areas in which they work. And so being involved in the admin law subsection is a way of staying current on issues in administrative law. So that's a matter of one's professional practice. In terms of giving back, you know, it's important for lawyers that do have some experience or expertise in an area to help facilitate that process for other lawyers. In other words, the process of remaining current and developing expertise. And so as the chair of that subsection, we would arrange for speakers to give talks on issues that were important in administrative law or emerging in administrative law. You know, that's obviously helpful to the profession, particularly helpful to more junior lawyers who are looking to gain experience in that area.
I kind of wanted to come back to the idea of legal education a little bit and ask you, you know, you've been involved over the years in law schools. How do you think legal education has changed, let's say, since you were a student to where we are now?
I'm not sure I'm close enough to it to know the answer to that. I mean, I have impressions and I have no idea if they are valid. One of the impressions I have for what this is worth is that the focus on what used to be described as core areas has diminished. And so when one looks at the hiring at UBC in the last number of years, what I see, and this is not intended as a criticism, it's just an observation, but what I see is hiring in a lot of narrow specialized areas that will not be the core of most students' practice when they get out into the profession. And what I have not been seeing is hiring focused on core areas and expertise in core areas. So if you look at what most students of the law school are going to do when they get out of law school, it's going to be, you know, solicitor's work, which involves, you know, obviously expertise in corporate law, transactional law, insurance issue, you know, issues associated to those issues, things like trust, for example. You know, there's a number of others, but, and then there's going to have a huge number of people that are going to be in criminal law, and you're going to have a huge number of people that are going to be in litigation, whether it be commercial or otherwise. And, you know, the people that are involved in litigation obviously are going to have to be experts in contracts and torts, administrative law. You know, they're also going to have these core issues under their belts, like insurance and corporations and trust and so on. And that's, you know, those are the areas where most students of the law school are going to end up needing most proficiency, core courses. And that's not to take away from the non-core courses, which are hugely interesting and also important. So don't get me wrong. But my impression, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, but my impression is, just looking at UBC, is that there has been a tendency not to place as much focus as I would think wise on core areas and not to put a premium on hiring the top people in core course areas. That's just my own observation. I don't know if it's true, but that's my sense of things. Apart from that, I mean, I think the other thing that's happening, which is good, is that the law school seems to be putting an emphasis on clinical programs. I think that was part of the package when the Allard money came in. It seems that there are a number of very good clinical programs at the law school, and that this is something the law school has put a lot of effort into. And I think that is a development which is probably happening elsewhere across the country as well, that I think is a very good development. So I've given you one that I think is slightly negative and one that's positive.
Yeah. And as someone who I imagine, you know, has to work with young lawyers and new graduates, is there something that you'd like to see changed or added to the way that law is taught now in terms of how it prepares people who are entering the field?
Well, I'm not close enough to the law school to be able to comment much on how it's being taught. I mean, I have some sense from the students that we get at our firm, and some sense I know a few faculty members there, but I don't have a clear enough sense to give you a firm answer on that. I mean, I think law schools always struggle with the extent to which they should be solely an academic institution versus an academic and vocational institution. Mm-hmm. And my own view on that has always been that it should be both. And sometimes you see law schools head almost sort of exclusively toward an academic model. And my own view is it's not a great approach, because it's not coming to terms with the reality that the vast majority of the students are being prepared for a profession, for life. I will make this observation. It's not intended to be kind of grouchy, but having taught there for 8 or so years, and having spoken extensively with my wife, who you may know teaches there as well, my impression is that it takes quite a while for students to wrap their heads around what it means to be a professional and what it means to act professionally. And again, I'm not intending to be griping. That's not what this is about. But I think students would benefit from some teaching in that regard. Again, for the reason I stated, which is that the vast majority of them are about to enter a profession. And the law school may think, well, that's the role for the law society. It's not our role. But I don't entirely agree with that. I'm of the view that the law school should go some distance toward helping students prepare for the profession that the vast majority of them are about to enter.
For law students, the academics and the importance of learning and doing well are kind of the self-explanatory part, but another important aspect of law school I found so far are the connections you make in the mentorship that you get from those who've navigated this process with some level of success. What advice would you give to a law student who's wondering about things and how they're going to transition into the profession?
Well, let's make no bones about it. It's a tough adjustment for most people. You know, the profession of law, at least in most circles, is a demanding profession. You're walking into a very demanding environment where the expectations on you are not what you're used to. And this goes back to my previous comment about, you know, the concept of what it means to be a professional. I don't think most students have a handle on that. And so it can be a bit of a shock to some of them to land in that environment without preparation. And, you know, I think it's also really important for students to try and think early on about what it is that they like and what it is that's important to them. And when I say what they like, I don't mean what subjects in law did they like, although that is important. But what kind of interactions do they like as a human being? Are they more of a backroom person? Do they want to be out front as an advocate? Is research their passion? Is, you know, evolution of the law what they're really about? Is helping poor people what's going to really motivate them in life? Do they want to be on the forefront of certain kinds of business transactions? You know, and these are the important questions that students, I don't know how many students ask themselves these sort of things, but that's what they ought to be asking themselves in the early stages of their career and even before they enter the profession. Because if they have a good handle on those sorts of things, they can then get meaningful guidance on where they should try and land. Because I'm sure you have heard this, but there's a sort of epidemic out there of law students who go to the large national firms. They're in a particular corporate milieu at that point that has certain expectations and demands of junior people who have a particular role within a much bigger structure. And a lot of them realize it's not what they want. They're not getting fulfillment. They're being overworked. They're stressed. They're not having any joy. And a lot of them don't stay. Or they get told to leave because they're not fulfilling the expectation, perhaps in part because their heart's not in it. I don't know. But there are a huge number of students that go through that. And, you know, I think it would be great if the law school did more. And I can't say that I know everything they are doing, but it would be great if they did more to work with students to think about what's really important to them and then to help channel them in directions that might help them land in places that they might be happier with.
We've spoken about all things law and law school so far. Can you tell me a bit about what you're interested in or passionate about outside of this world of law?
I think one of the things that I'm interested and passionate about has to do with food. So everything from growing it to cooking it to eating it. You know, I've tried to turn myself into a vegetable gardener, and that's been fairly successful. And I have a long-standing interest in cooking. Oh. And think that if I ever quit the practice of law, that might be something I put a lot more focus and effort into. So, other interests, I've always had an interest in soccer, and have been involved in the soccer world my entire life, first as a player and for the past close to 15 years now as a coach of girls soccer in Vancouver.
I mean, I say that those things are separate from the law, but in many ways, I think I've realized that those kinds of things are part of having a healthy relationship to the law. Being able to step outside of it once in a while to do something else you enjoy.
I'll tell you, you are absolutely right when you say that. And the extent to which you're right becomes more and more apparent the longer you stay in the profession. Early on in one's career, one is capable of complete devotion to the law with extremely long hours that later become more punishing as you get older. And I'm finding that the need for outlets outside of the law has increased in recent years for me as I've gotten older.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been really fascinating.
You're very welcome.